Today's episode of The Scathing Atheist is brought to you by the Jehovah's Witness Protection Program. So if you're tired of the J-dubs loitering on your porch and you find that candles and birthday cake just don't scare them off the way they used to, turn to the experts in cruel and elaborate front porch security systems. Act now and get three free alligators when you upgrade to the new Moat and Drawbridge package. Jehovah's Witness Protection, because there are worse things to have on your porch than a flaming bag of shit. And now, The Scathing Atheist.
And the Lord showed me that Satan wounded me as a woman, and so therefore I was carrying that pain in my body until it grew into a tumor.
Hi, I'm Phil from The Week in Doubt, and we did in fact evolve from filthy monkey men.
Thursday, it's September 19th, and this sentence is a palindrome, ordinal apostasic nitnesit. I'm your host, No Illusions, and from Rapture City, New York, New York, this is The Scathing Atheist. On this week's episode, Lucinda will join us in the Holy Babel segment to take the edge off the concubine gang rape jokes. Christians will drink poop, and we'll learn that every time a pastor beats you off, a fairy gets its wings. But first, the diatribe. Who has one of those jobs where occasionally you have to take phone calls from people who bitch at you for things that you have nothing to do with. And for our younger listeners, by the way, phone calls are like real-time voice-activated audio texts. Anyway, so the other day I ran into him and he was dying to tell me about one such conversation. Some dude had called to complain about some policy that was set by a guy in another country, so while he's bitching, my buddy explains to him that he doesn't actually set the company's policies and has no control over them, to which his animated caller goes all prematurely Godwin and tells him that makes him no different than the guards at them their concentration camps. Exhibiting a nearly Herculean amount of patience, my friend calmly asked the guy to dial back his rhetoric a bit, and then the jerk tosses out a response so indefensibly stupid I had to write a diatribe about it. He said, "You'll have to forgive me, I'm a pastor. I'm used to fighting for the weak." Now, I don't want to bog this down with boring details of the policy the guy was complaining about, so suffice to say that him bitching about it had about as little to do with fighting for the weak as being a pastor does, so I can only imagine the befuddled silence and stifled laughter that this assertion actually provoked. My first thought upon hearing it was, fight for the weak, eh? So you guys are paying taxes now? Because every time I earn a dollar, a chunk of it goes to the weak. Every time I pay my property taxes, they go to the weak. How about you? Who pays your tax-free salary again? The weak? Got it. But that's far from being the most ludicrous delusion in that sentence. This person is actually invoking a career and taking advantage of people, deluding people, indoctrinating children, fighting against reality, opposing social progress, and believing in fairy tales. And for this, he thinks he's entitled to some level of respect. I'm not just stupid. I majored in stupid. I have an advanced degree in stupid. I've devoted my life to stupid. And yet somehow I'm still not impressed. I'd be more impressed if you had a master's degree in My Little Ponies, because My Little Ponies are actually pretty awesome. But brony or no, I can guarantee you, you're going to find more morality in those cartoons than you'll find in the Bible. I'm a pastor. And for that, you deserve some kind of deference? You know, given the fact that we're going to be leading off headlines this week with a story about a pastor raping children for the third week in a row, I don't know how the fuck you try to attach that profession with morality. You know, if the guy said, "You'll have to forgive me, I'm a pastor, I'm used to sexually abusing the weak," I'd simply have applauded him for his honesty. You know, the very fact that such a thing as a degree in theology exists is an insult to education. Think about it, we'd be pretty fucked if we woke up tomorrow and all the world's surgeons were gone, or all the world's physicists, or all the world's firefighters, or teachers, or plumbers, or carpenters, or jizz moppers, or truck drivers, or pharmacists, and we'd be at least horribly inconvenienced if we woke up tomorrow and there were no more podcasters, jugglers, musicians, or masked vigilantes. But what would happen if we lost all the theologists? Gee, where would we get our nothing? If all the world's pastors were abducted by aliens tomorrow, who would molest our children? Who would fleece our uneducated? Who would terrify our nieces and nephews? Who would hate our fags? Yeah, you're a pastor. You want to impress me? Try getting a real job. Here, I've got an idea. How about one where you have to take phone calls from assholes like you?
They're talking about your Jesus.
We interrupt this broadcast to bring you a special news bulletin.
Joining me for
headlines tonight is No Illusions, because if I talk first, then you're joining me. I mean, we're both already here.
What the hell, dude? Next thing I know, you're going to be trying to beat me to the lead
story. In our lead
story
tonight, a pastor in Iowa claims allegations of sexual abuse against him are just another big misunderstanding. Ex-pastor Brent Giroux pioneered a procedure he calls a semen exorcism, in which he jerks off kids until they stop being gay.
All right, so the movie version would obviously be called Redeeming the Semen Demon. But I can't decide if Michael Bay or Steven Soderbergh would direct. That would be two radically different directions. One way or the other, Sharon Stone plays Pastor Giroux.
Absolutely. Is it Giroux? All right. I don't want to pronounce his name wrong.
I think you had it wrong before. I'm more confident.
All right, Giroux. It's Giroux. Giroux. We'll go with Giroux. He credits his success, by the way, to such awful handjob technique that even women do it better. In particular, poor sense of cock and also bad calluses or the lumberjacking effect. Used in a sentence, I got lumberjacked by Pastor Brent and now I prefer vagina.
I don't know. I'm finding his excuse a little hard to, you know, splash on my tits.
One self-proclaimed rape victim, or exercise partner, argued, quote, but you can see how someone might think they were the victim of a gay pedophile, right? End quote.
Isn't it sad that the pastor rape child stories have to have an angle now to be newsworthy? I mean, if it wasn't for this Dingleberry convincing himself that he could clear things up with the, hey, it isn't rape if we were praying defense, this would be a non-story. What, pastor raped 60 kids over a period of decades? How is that news?
Somehow convinced he could smooth things over, the allegedly disgraced gay sexorcist allegedly spoke to detectives and had words to say. Here are those words. Keep in mind, this is an adult talking to police about his activities with kids, trying not to get arrested. Quote, when they would ejaculate, now right there, already a bad start. Quote, when they would ejaculate, they would be getting rid of the evil thoughts in their mind, end quote.
In his defense, the science does back him up there, though. Thinking about ejaculating, ejaculating. Those are the only two settings for the teenage male brain.
And in case you're wondering if his punishment will be as stiff as his altar boys, 60 counts of sexual exploitation will land him in jail for as many as 24 hours. He might leave after lunch if he doesn't manually service anyone inappropriately that morning.
Yeah, the guy was originally sentenced to 17 years, but it was later reduced to probation and treatment when it was pointed out that the kids he molested didn't turn gay. So, and in convenient,
archaeology news, an Israeli team has uncovered a new cache of Jew gold and some other really old, unfabricated stuff, proving conclusively that Judaism actually existed long before 1948, like many people believe. Along with 36 gold coins and a medallion with a menorah drawing, they found a tablet etching that read, Jewish Jesus was here first.
Well, if nothing else, I suppose that finally settles the who owns the Temple Mount question. That's a shame, though. I was kind of holding out hope that it would ultimately be adjudicated by a winner-take-all wet burka contest.
That would be fun. I judge that. Just when Israel was about to cave and peacefully concede a bunch of land to Palestine, they find perfectly preserved title deeds corresponding precisely to all the dibs in the Old Testament, including Holy Waterworks and all four railroads. I don't think they're going to cave on that land anymore.
Wouldn't it be nice, though, if they could just talk it out like a Monopoly trade? Tell you what, I'll give you Marvin Gardens and hotels for Gaza. You give me the Temple Mount and that green one. You weren't using the green one. You can't put houses on it.
This all sounds like rock-solid proof of cosmic historical ownership to me. I'm sure they would reconsider if they ever found an Islamic artifact buried in Jerusalem, which they clearly have not. All of a sudden, you might see the stubborn side of Netanyahu, as opposed to his normal silky-smooth, placating diplomacy with neighboring so-called countries. Okay, sarcastically mocking the Jews, check. Are the Christians up to any stupid shit?
And in the... And in... You gonna...
No, go ahead.
All right. And in the holy shit joke would be too easy news tonight, a recent study has discovered that the majority of the world's holy water contains dangerous amounts of fecal matter. Because when we said the church was feeding you shit, we only thought it was metaphorical.
I fucking love it. Christians are honest to God shit sippers. The only way this gets worse for them is getting that awkward email from Jesus saying he has AIDS and everybody who had contact with his blood should probably get... tested. A lot of you have been drinking it every Sunday.
Shit.
Look into that.
Austrian researchers sampled water from 39 different holy springs and church fonts and discovered that the water was so blessed with vitality it was home to some 62 million bacteria per milliliter, including E. coli, enterococci, and campylobacter, a combination that comes in handy for anyone who needs to projectile defecate through a coffee filter and then die.
Christianity. Drink shit and die. That's an interesting take on it. You'd hope the church will finally have to break down and apologize for literally feeding their shit to the public. Then the public shitting it out, wiping it on their hand, dipping it in the church basin, and then ingesting more shit, and then lethally projectile shitting out diarrhea, which is made up of the holy shit they drank.
Dr. Alexander Kirschner, a microbiologist from the Medical University of Vienna, recommended that priests act responsibly and put up signs warning people that the holy water has as much shit as the sermon. But loyal Christian sewage garglers point out that they're only drinking blessed remnants of fecal matter.
Holy water number two cause of Christians being full of shit. Moving on, according to a pastor in Houston, all contracts are void if either party has their delicate religious sensibilities offended in the process. Apostle Michael Canty of the Truth Ministries Holiness Church, which sounds a lot like a government building from 1984, refused to marry a couple because the bride's dress was too revealing for him.
Now, according to the article on friendlyatheist.com, the family assumed the pastor was wearing out a crappy joke when he repeatedly asked where the rest of the dress was. Upon discovering that, no, this wasn't the pre-dress or anything, the pastor demanded that the bride-to-be cover up her breast area and lengthen the dress in 30 minutes, or he was taking his balls and going home.
It's a pre-dress? Well, that's not pre-cum on my frock, so don't worry about it. Granted, the so-called wedding dress looks more like a tearaway stripper warm-up uniform, but demanding a last-minute iron-on burka attachment is asinine.
Right, and I look, nothing says slutty like, I now take this man to be my lawfully wedded husband. What the fuck is this point anyway?
All things considered, you probably don't want to be married by a guy with a visible erection anyway. But it is refreshing, you got to admit, to see a pastor aroused by an adult female.
True.
That's nice.
True. I can just see it now. Anyone who objects to this bridal gown should forever hold his peace, or at least tuck it over to one side and put it under his belt so the bulge isn't as noticeable. And in the strong forearm of the law news tonight, it turns out that an Indonesian lawmaker whose career has been defined by a single-minded obsession with pornography is obsessed with pornography.
Forearm of the law.
50-year-old conservative MP Arafinto championed a law that called for prison terms for everything from public kissing to displaying lewd artwork, and then managed to get caught surreptitiously watching pornography during a parliamentary debate.
In fairness, though, it's important to point out that Arafinto's not usually known as a master debater at these events. He must have decided to get his feet wet that day.
Images of the newly disgraced, newly unemployed hypocrite drooling over Pornhub were captured by a photojournalist and quickly found their way into newspapers throughout the nation. Indonesia, which boasts the world's largest population of Muslims, could not be reached as the porn-starved nation was busy rubbing one out to the blurred images of whatever Arafinto was looking at. Well, that's going to do it for headlines tonight. Heath,
thanks for joining me tonight.
And when we come back, Lucinda will join us to take some of the sting out of how bad the Bible sucks. So I think we can all agree that eventually this whole poem shtick is going to wear thin if I don't change it up here and there. So now I'd like to present the Book of Judges in limerick. There were a series of Jews tasked with judging through God's incessant fits and begrudging. So quick, alert CNN as we learn once again that God's a testy, forgetful curmudgeon. The first judge, Ehum, was left-handed. The Jews angered God so they got reprimanded by an oppressive fat lord, so Ehum took his sword and shoved it so deep in the king's gut it got stranded. Deborah, the next judge, saw visions, upon which the Jews made decisions. Sisera's armies attack, so she goes with Barak and they use a stake as their chief ammunition. Then there's Gideon, who's kind of a dick. He kills Midianites with a trumpet-based trick. With 300 men he achieves something as hard to believe as that god-awful Zack Snyder flick. There's Abimelech from just south of Ephraim, who figured all the Jews should obey him, so he tried to kill all his brothers, but the youngest recovered, and then suggested his subjects should slay him. Then Jephthah, who is the son of Ahor, took an oath to the Almighty. He swore that if his campaign didn't fail and God let them prevail, he'd kill the first person that walked out his door. Bad idea, as it turns out. There was also this fella named Samson. He was strong, he could fight, he was handsome. He set fire to some crops, so they called the Ammonite cops, and on his head they placed a king's ransom. They demanded that he succumb to the law, but it turned out that their plan had a flaw. Despite all their hopes, he broke through their ropes and then killed 1,000 men with an animal jaw. But then along came a chick named Delilah, who Samson had the urge to defile. So as long as it took, there was good advice in this book. Don't let your girlfriend be your hairstyler.
The Holy Babble.
Ah, Judges, the disjointed and chronologically perplexing series of pointless short stories that really make you appreciate the parts of your life you spend not reading them. So joining me to dig through the morass of spasmodic drivel is my lovely wife, Lucinda. Lucinda, welcome to the show.
Good to be here, Noah.
And, of course, to my left is my right-hand man, Heath Enright. Heath, thanks for not stepping on my intro here.
No problem. Wouldn't think of it.
So, obviously, Judges ranks high in terms of utter irrelevance. What say we dive right in?
So, basically, Joshua is dead, and God didn't think to have the divine Rico chart figured out in advance like he did with Moses. So they just go ahead and kill everybody because, damn it, that's what Old Testament Jews do.
The chapter's all over the place, too, but it has all the staples we've come to expect out of the Bible. There's slavery, xenophobia, incest, betrayal, but most of all, genocide.
And you know there's a lot of genocide in a book when, by the end, they just start listing the tribes that weren't completely massacred.
They actually do.
Yeah.
And just when you thought it was a little cruel to cut off the opposing general's thumbs and big toes, the guy laughs it off in confirmation of the Jews' legendary comedic timing.
And, of course, if you're not genociding correctly, you're going to piss God off. So in Chapter 2, he sends an angel to bitch out the Jews for not murdering thoroughly enough.
Yeah, half-assed genocide's never a good move. That's just normal mass murder. That's like swimming 90% across a river, seeing a few non-Jews on shore and turning back without murdering them. That's ridiculous. You'd never do that.
And then Chapter 3 contains the weirdest assassination we've encountered yet. Ehud the Left-Handed kills Eglon the Fat. He pretends he has a secret message from God, gets the king by himself, then kills him with a sword he'd been hiding in his taint. And then he locks the door so everybody will think the king's just taking a massive shit while he makes his escape.
Then there's this only slightly less odd assassination of Sisera in Chapter 4. Here we meet Deborah, who is judging Israel at the moment, and she defeats an army with 900 chariots of iron. You go, girl.
Yeah. But during the ensuing battle, Sisera escapes on foot, and he finds some chick in a tent. He's all like, hide me, hide me. And she says, sure, no problem. Come right in. And then as soon as he falls asleep, she drives a fucking tent pole through his head.
What the fuck?
What?
Yael, Gentile vampires there. How do you hammer a post through somebody's temple while they're sleeping anyway? Did she tap it in really softly to get it started? It's just not believable. Women hammer nails about as well as they merge in traffic and earn equal pay anyway, so I just can't see this happening.
I think Deborah is the first woman we meet in the Bible that doesn't get raped, murdered, sold, turned into a leper, or forced to mutilate a penis at some point. It's ridiculous.
Yeah, starting with Judges, it looks like the Bible might start getting a little too preachy with the feminism. I just hope their progressive stance doesn't take away from the rapey narrative that's working so nicely so far.
So God fucks with the Jews for a while, gets bored with it, and then he appears to Gideon and tells him to kill all the Midianites.
And of course Gideon's skeptical, so he says, if you're really God, make this rug wet when I wake up in the morning.
Yeah, what?
It's like an odd test of divinity. What is that? Hey God, bet you can't piss on this rug, but apparently God obviously passed that test. And
so Gideon gathers his army to attack the Midianites, and God tells him any god could kick ass with that big of an army. Send all but 300 of them home, otherwise people will think I'm a pussy.
So Gideon, get this, he sends home all the soldiers that don't lap river water up with their tongue like dogs.
What?
And then they kick all the Midianite asses with trumpets in irrational fear.
These weird-ass, canine-tongued soldiers lift their legs and pee on the fallen enemies. See them start licking the blood from the open wounds. It's a little gross, but still somehow cute and endearing, like puppies are.
Then in chapter 8, Gideon kills the kings and anyone else that fucks with him at that point. Then he takes enough wives to have 70 sons and drops dead.
And something of a pattern seems to be emerging, because as soon as Gideon dies, the Jews go right back to worshipping Baal again.
It seems like the only time they stop worshipping Baal is when some crazy fucking zealot announces the next genocide mission he heard from real God. So the lesson we're supposed to learn here is, you can spot a false god when they don't sponsor regular tribal murder sprees? What? Take away from that.
Next, we get the brief reign of Abimelech the Easily Provoked. He wakes up one day and says, hey, Mom, wouldn't it be awesome if I was king? And then he kills his dad and all his brothers except the youngest one, takes over the promised land, spends a few years killing anybody who insinuates he has a small dick, and then gets killed by a chick with a millstone.
I'm girthy.
And because the only thing worse than death is a vagina in this book, Abimelech is stammering around with his head half crushed in, trying to find a man who can stab him to death so people won't think a woman killed him.
Will a man please finish me off and murder me? This is embarrassing. I'm about to die at a woman's hand.
And since fuck originality, the Israelites piss off God once again, and he lets the Philistines make slaves out of them.
So after a couple of decades of slavery, the Jews are going, okay, sorry about the worshipping Baal again. We're sorry again. So can you go ahead and deliver us again, please? And God's like, no, fuck off this time.
And then you get this very weird story about Jephthah, where he has to offer up his daughter because she's the first person to come out of his house when he gets home, which apparently means she has to spend 2 months on a mountain, never get to fuck anyone, and has to be burned to death for God when she gets home.
He was clearly expecting his wife to come out first when he made that bet. Or maybe his whore mother, one or the other.
And then we meet Samson, who was apparently immaculately conceived a la Jesus.
Right. This is a tough sell to your husband. So you know how I'm barren and you're impotent? Well, I talked to this angel, and he said if I can handle his angel cock, he'll give us a kid. Who's a main character in the book? Are you hearing this? Main character. We got to take the deal.
So Samson grows up. He finds a Philistine chick he wants to bone. So he tells his parents to go get her. Because apparently that's how it worked back then.
Then Samson gives his friends a riddle, which is what everyone wants to do at a dinner party. And it's a bullshit riddle anyway, because you needed to know that if you murder a lion barehanded, you can later eat honey from its rotting, bee-infested carcass. How is that an acceptable prerequisite for a riddle? Riddles don't have prerequisites. That's what riddles are. That's what six-year-olds do when they try to tell their own shitty riddle.
Yeah.
Sucks.
Yeah, and then he gives his wife to his best man because he doesn't like her, or apparently his best man.
Then he changes his mind. He decides he does want to bone his wife after all, but then he goes back to get her, and the dad's like, too late, dude. She's shacked up with the best man.
So in a rage, he ties torches to a bunch of cute little foxes, lights them on fire, and then sends them running through their fields.
So they demand Samson, and the Jews oblige, and then Samson goes all Samson on them. He melts the ropes with his anger, and then kills 1,000 men with the jawbone of a donkey. And don't forget, now, this book's infallible.
So they're saying Samson took his bone from the mouth of an ass. That's what they're saying, on record.
You never go ass to
it just sounds unkosher, right?
In chapter 16, we meet the foul temptress we all knew was coming. Samson falls for Delilah, and she likes it kinky, because basically the first words out of her mouth is, how could you be tied up?
And first of all, this isn't a red flag to him at first. But after the fifth time, he says some weird random, here's how to capture me lie, then wakes up to her fucking trying it. He eventually tells her the truth,
right?
Which is apparently that Barbasol is his kryptonite.
So then the Philistines promptly shave him, capture him, gouge out his eyeballs, and make him dance like a monkey.
Yeah, gouging eyes is also his
kryptonite. But no, get this, he dances like a monkey so long that his hair grows back out, so he brings down the temple because he has his magical powers back. And if he can kill 1,000 people with an ass bone, you can only imagine how much ass he can kick with a whole fucking temple.
Yeah, praise to God for the strength to kill himself and 1,000 other people in a building collapse. Does this sound familiar? Turns out the first suicide bomber was Jewish. Who knew?
And then 17 and 18 suck. He got Micah, Danite shrine murder, whatever. But then shit gets real, because we meet some unnamed coward from the hill country. He's traveling from Bethlehem with his concubine. Some old dude invites him to crash at his place. So far, so good. And then the town folks show up at the old man's door demanding that he send out his guest so they can ass rape him.
Seems to be a running motif here. To be fair, though, in King James, they didn't specify ass rape. For all we know, they just wanted to work with the ear, nose, and throat. Maybe, so.
But we already know what they do in this situation. Just offer the crowd your concubine and maybe your virgin daughter.
Yeah, the playbook.
So they shove the women out of the house so the crowd can rape them to death.
Right, nothing calms down a mob of gay rapists like some vagina? Maybe they figured she's a virgin, so, you know, it's pretty tight. That's almost like two assholes on one person, right? More bang for your shekel and your schmeckle. Shekel, schmeckle. They rhyme.
So in the morning, this asshole wakes up, opens the door, and there's his concubine lying dead from being gang raped, and he toes her a little bit and says, "Get up, we're leaving."
Exact words. Exactly. I checked that IV, can do the same words. Get up, we're leaving.
We're leaving, that's it.
And then he finally realizes she's dead, so of course he brings her home, chops her into pieces, and then mails the pieces to different parts of the country with a note saying, "Man, Israel really sucks these days. It's just gotten to the point where you can't offer your concubine to a bunch of salivating rapists without them fucking her to death."
And it's gotten to the point where you get disembodied, abused corpse pieces with the mail, too.
Unbelievable. Can a man not block a rape with his whore shield in this town anymore? Fucking speaking of which, can a guy not get a decent whore shield in this town anymore? Maybe one that doesn't die on her first biblical rape mob? It's like having your starting QB go down an injury in week one. Those are equally bad things. I thought this was the promised land. Are we not in the promised land? Do I really need to dismember my dead sex slave to teach Israelites how to rally around a good cause again? Unbelievable.
So in hopes of putting an end to all the violence, the Israelites gather an army and attack Gibeah. Takes a few tries, but eventually they kill the whole army, murder all the women, children, slaughter the livestock, burn the city to the ground so that no one would get hurt. And then you get the most high-stakes game of not it ever. The Jews say, "We can't marry our daughters off to these Benjamite scum, so let's kill all the non-virgins in Jabesh Gilead. That should be enough virgins for all the Benjamites."
No, it's not.
Of course not.
So then they decide to just kidnap a bunch of dancing ladies to round things off a bit.
That's fair. I feel bad withholding all the Jew pussy from the Benjamites. We should at least throw them like a themed virgins and sluts party or something. Yeah. Half prude, half crude. Lots of oil. Like a righty-tighty, lefty-loosey type of party. Okay, admittedly, I'm stretching the orifice jokes at this point.
It's all right. We forgive you.
We're going to cram one in the last minute.
I don't think we have room for any more. That's going to have to wrap up the Holy Babble this week. Heath, Lucinda, thanks for not bailing on this insanely boring project yet.
No problem.
Our next book is Ruth, which is really short, even for a pamphlet, so we get a bit of a reprieve. We'll be back for that one in episode 34. So until then, fuck this stupid book.
Fuck it up its ass.
Baby Ruth.
Before we lick the envelope tonight, I wanted to make a quick correction to next week's episode. I'm going to accidentally misidentify Charles S. Durnham as Charles S. Dunham. I just wanted to apologize in advance for that. I also wanted to remind everybody that I took part in a two-part panel discussion with Jake Farr Wharton over at the Imaginary Friends Show, along with Martin S. Pribble and Twitter's very own Gamma Atheist. Both episodes are available over at ImaginaryFriendsShow.com. We had a blast recording it. I'd highly recommend them. You'll find the link on this week's show notes. I also have a few quick thanks to toss out. Thanks, of course, to the lovely and talented Lucinda Illusions for joining us this week. Thanks also to the talented but decidedly less lovely Heath Enright for kicking ass, taking names, and then kicking those names asses. I also need to thank Phil from the Week in Doubt podcast for providing this week's Farnsworth quote. He's a very intelligent guy, and it really comes across on his podcast. It's well-researched, well-presented, and if you want to check it out, you'll find a link to his website on the show notes for this episode as well. But most of all, of course, I need to thank this week's most structurally sound arrangements of organic molecules, Hank, Bruce, Josh, Ryan, Elsa, and Magnus the Great Dane, who is either a dog or an exemplary person from Denmark, but either way makes my short list of people I'd most like to have at my side when fending off the impending alien apocalypse. These superior examples of humanity and or caninity have proved their worth to the species, the planet, and the galaxy this week by giving us money. Secure in the knowledge that giving us money is the universal currency of decency, Hank, Bruce, Josh, Ryan, Elsa, and Magnus the Great Dane can maintain their claim to moral supremacy even if they should later take to a life of drugs, crime, and aardvark prostitution, which they won't. If you think that you have the superior wit, wisdom, and worth required to give us money, you'll find the donate button on the right side of the homepage at scathingatheist.com. And if you'd like to help, but you wasted all your money on food and diapers, you can still help us a ton by leaving us a 5-star review on iTunes, following us on Twitter and Facebook and YouTube, and adding us to your favorites on Stitcher, or maybe naming an asteroid after us. If you have questions, comments, or death threats, you'll find all the contact info on the contact page at scathingatheist.com. All the music used in this episode was written and performed by yours truly, and yes, I did have my permission. Do you know that one?
That'd be Enter a Cockeye, I'm pretty sure.
Okay. Enter a...
We're saying it that way.
Yeah,
anyway.
Okay.